let me attempt to tie it all together feebly, because it's a meandering conversation, but I kind of, you know, I thought a lot about the theme of this season, and I don't think there's going to be one, and it might be meandering at times, because most of our seasons have kind of been a reflection of where my mind is at, and that's an honest reflection of where my mind is at. I think a lot about kids.
But isn't that a much more honest place to come from it? That's a reflection of where you are at.
I'm accepting that. I agree.
And also from where the, I don't know, not just middle-aged life, which God help us, we're now in, but the world writ large.
Yeah.
It's messy.
It's very messy.
May one, you know, embrace that.
Let's do it. Let's do a season of meandering mess. I'm all for it.
Hell yeah.
Hey, Dad.
Hey, Mary.
You son of a bitch. I never made one of these when you were still responding because I was so mad at you for leaving. And then when you went quiet, it seemed like I should live with that decision, and I have. Today's my birthday. And it's a special one because you told me. You once told me that when you came back, we might be the same age. And today I'm the age you were when you left. So it'll be a real good time for you to come back.
I'm John Totten, and this is Between Us.
All right.
Feeling better now?
Yeah. All the annoying things that pile up throughout the day.
I know. I know, man. And your day's only, Jesus, it's barely begun.
I just made eggs and toast for everyone.
Nice.
Have my coffee here. Got to sleep in a little bit this morning till 7.
Nice.
Welcome to a new season of Between Us. It's been a long time since I talked to you. In our next episode, I'll talk more about what I've been doing since you heard me last. I'll also wrongly identify how long it's been because I started working on our next episode early last year. That's kind of how this season is going to be. It's a collage of interviews and reflections I had mostly over the year 2023. It's actually been nearly 3 years since we published an interview. I spent most of that time with my wife and 2 kids and working. You'll hear more as we go on about what prompted me to get back to the podcast. Today, I really just want to present you with a sort of preface to the season. It's an interesting one to me. I spoke with a lot of friends, and I spoke to a lot of people I consider luminaries. The theme that you'll hear emerge the most is how I failed to not have themes. Some of them were topical concerning things happening in the news. We are going to discuss the violence currently happening in Gaza. But a lot of the themes were clinical. We talk about disclosure. We talk about the proliferation of therapy and psychoanalytic language. We talk about ethics. We talk about Martin Buber. We don't escape the inclusion of the political. And as I'm starting to do right now, we ramble a bit. Whenever I feel aimless about this podcast, I check in with Mason, my co-producer and friend. We decided to check in for the first episode of this season to reflect on last season and to look forward to the upcoming one. I caught up with Mason, who lives in Cardiff, Wales, after my own frustrating morning of technological issues and taking care of the kids.
I remember a time when sleeping in until 7 was not a phrase I would have understood.
I mean, because our bee woke up so early, so young. We now have trained her that however early she wakes up, she cannot get out of her room until 7. I mean, 7 is as good as it gets.
Yeah, we're making progress in that area. Like, waking up and playing by yourself, starting to be a thing.
You just do you. And before 7, no one cares. But you just don't get out of bed until 7. Because yours are what?
We'll have in a month and a half, 5 and 3.
My God, you're in the fucking buzzsaw, man. You're in the buzzsaw. You are in the danger zone.
I know. Highway to it.
You're there, man.
Yeah, and it's not the second child, but the combo of the two can really be quite something. The second child has all the staples of like a youngest child, you know, big fan of dad, very affable, very like likes to mug and cheer everybody up and be silly. She's a real delight. But the combo of the two, and they get, yeah, the frequency can get jacked up, really.
I think because the universe decided it was one for us. I won't say that it is less complex because there just aren't the parties to manage.
Yeah.
But in terms of, as particularly as she gets older, she forms two very intense relationships with us simultaneously. Mm-hmm. And then the three of us have a very intense relationship, but they're very different in a lot of ways, mm-hmm. which I'm sure is exactly the case. Obviously, that's the case with any kid with, you know, two parents in the home. But to do that, to do two of that at once, couldn't imagine.
It's pretty wild.
Your reward is in heaven.
That's the only place
I have a chance of getting one. It's not going to be with your arborist.
Here is a truckload of money to trim some branches.
How much does an arborist set you back in Greater Seattle?
This is going to be really interesting listening. But I found this guy who was willing to do, he didn't have like a minimum. And that's what made him
Wait, just cheap. Like one branch.
Yeah, $1,000, one branch. Usually my minimum is a 4-branch. 4,000. So, like, I paid this guy $1,000. He did great work, by the way.
Nice.
Really nice guy. Great work.
I've got this arborist. He's the best. Everyone knows it.
The raccoons can no longer get onto my roof. And it was like $1,000 for like an hour.
Now, as we are now 2.5 years into a, you know, full blood and guts home renovation. I think it's those sorts of figures that you just have to get used to. Everything at a minimum costs £1,000. It's like, I mean, I don't gamble and I never did, but it's like, you know, a poker game where it's like minimum bet £1,000. Anything you want. You want a guy to like come and like polish a thing, £1,000.
Yeah.
Cut down a tree, £1,000.
Yeah.
You know, take the tree away, another £1,000. That's just how adult life works.
Now, I don't think it used to work that way, but this is where society has gone, is that we've decided that everything's going to cost an arm and a leg all the time, and no one's going to be able to afford anything.
But, I mean, surely if you just want some shit trimmed, you just need one of those, the pruning things with the thing and the rope, and you pull it, and you trim the thing. You can do that.
No, I know what it is. I like hearing you trying to describe it.
There's a thing and it goes up and there's this fucking...
Yeah. No, it's a bigger, it's a pretty big tree.
All right, man. You're doing well. It's a big fucking tree.
I'm not,
A mighty oak.
Yeah, you know, hey, I'm... I can't complain.
You're okay.
But I can't complain. Anyway. The podcast. I kind of thought this would be like maybe like a preamble to the season. We'll just talk about it. One thing that I'm kind of, I know this season won't hold together is like the timeliness and the pace at which we've produced this year being slower than even previous seasons, and there are going to be things that we talk about that maybe won't be current. There's going to be things kind of presented out of order. You'll hear me talk about my like 2 and 4 year old, and it's like, whoa, that was a year ago when I did that interview. You're going to hear me talk about ending therapy, which has now been a year. For the first time since my mid-20s, I've been out of therapy. That's one thing that I'm thinking about as I look, I'm kind of programming the season and like laying out all the episodes. I'm like, God, man, that Nancy McWilliams interview was in February of 2023.
As we are nearing the end of production on it, I like that. I like that we're not trying to be a topical show because things move too quickly. There are too many people shouting, trying to capture the present in the moment, trying to say something profound or edgy or interesting. As we had discussed, I think a few months ago, I think there's some charm in that.
Sure.
You know. So what do we need to talk about?
Well, you know, our next episode from here, I kind of front-loaded the season talking with my friends. I wanted to get back to some of that charm that was in our early seasons when I didn't have the ability to get, you know, well-known guests.
Yeah.
You know, one of the things that I say in our next episode is that coming into this podcast season, I really wasn't terribly excited about my career. It actually, I think, sustained my work with my patients. Like, I was able to, like, focus at work and then leave it behind when I left the office. Now, I think a year later, after doing the recordings, I'm different. Like, I think the podcast itself has kind of invigorated me in a way. Some of the guests that we have towards the end of the season are really inspiring and got me reading and thinking a lot. And so it's a bit of a John journey, I think, this season.
So what changed from then to now?
You know, there's a few guests that we're going to talk to this season that really were exciting to talk to. Nancy McWilliams being one of them, Stephen Kuchuk, Donna Orange. But I think the big one is that it'll be, probably episode 7 of this season or so. But I got invited down to the International Forum for Psychoanalytic Education to do our first live episode. And that was a kind of a watershed moment, I think, for the podcast. And it was also kind of getting me back into caring about psychoanalytic theory and being around therapists and so on and so forth. And so that was a big change.
So if the podcast was restorative, what was it like a year ago? Free restoration.
It was a slog, man. Yeah. I mean, you're saying before the restoration?
Yeah. If the production switched you on,
yeah.
Was it like being switched off?
No, it's a good question. I worked a lot during the pandemic. Like probably more than I should have. And part of that was there was a need. There were patients that were asking for therapy and their introduction emails felt moving and sympathetic. And then part of that was this stage of life being, you know, having 2 kids in childcare and everything being expensive all the time, like arborists. And so it wasn't even burnout. You know, there was an interesting thing about last season. I don't know, maybe we should talk about it. I can edit it out if I regret it. My interview with Jonathan Schedler affected me in 2 very opposite ways.
Okay.
Do you want to get into it?
Yeah, let's go.
You know, we did this season where we looked at, like, does the societal have a place in the treatment room and does psychoanalytic theory and thought have a place in helping society? And all of our guests but one had an answer that was like, of course. The answer is yes. Jonathan Schedler said pretty much no. He said the problems that psychotherapy deal with are internal problems of individual mind. That's what we have to work with.
That's the remit of the craft. That's as far as we can take it.
Exactly. I gave him an example of ageism because I thought, if I go to racism, if I go to sexism, it's going to be politicized. But I said, if you have a patient who's struggling with ageism, is that not something that psychotherapy can talk about or work on? And his response was essentially, and this was postscript, I read the emails in the episode, but he said, of course not. That's not a problem of the individual mind. What can I do to change ageism? I really didn't like that answer. And by the way, if you follow his Twitter feed, he's extremely online. I think that there is actually a case to be made that even when we say we're not political, we are belying something about being political. The tweets he likes a lot of tweets from this like libs of TikTok troll account. He challenges a lot of, I think, liberal narratives. And so, And so there was a bit of hypocrisy in that I think he's actually quite political. And then in this weird way, it helped me in my work in that it gave me freedom to think about with each patient, what are we actually working on here? If you want to come and talk about your anxieties about at the time, the Ukraine war or the rise of fascism in America, first of all, for me, that's fine, but I'm going to bring it back to your life and how it really affects your life and what is it that we're working on. Because in one way, he's right. I can't change those things. I can't influence those things. Now, I think the complex answer we got in our episode with Carlos Padron, because the complex answer is that we have internalized fascism. We have internalized wars. We internalize the societal, and it is a part of our individual psyche. And so that's the complex answer. And I think that that's where I think Shedler was wrong and maybe too reductionist in his answer about the relationship between the treatment room and society.
I think it would be helpful to explore why that affected you so much. Mm-hmm. I think, and it's interesting where that season fell, and it's interesting what was going on between COVID, mm-hmm. sort of the long tail of 2020, BLM. I think we are very quick to overstate the scope of the psychotherapeutic encounter as a revolutionary encounter. Hmm. I think that it has revolutionary potential, but I think that what that potential is, it's not so much an isolated individual, but it's, it's an intersubjective individual. It's a relational revolution. But it is boundaried. I do think we overstate, and I think in the aftermath of all that foment, particularly in the States, but it was over here as well in Britain, I think we are quick to apply, I don't know, whether it's Buber or, I don't know, a notion of actualization. I'm skeptical of the limits of what we can achieve on a social level as well.
I think you're right. I mean, I think, and this is why I don't want to, as much as Dr. Shedler's online habits are objectionable to me, I don't want to throw away what he said to me in the interview. I don't want to throw out the baby with the bathwater. I do think that there is something valuable to consider. I also think that Carlos Padron addressed it when he talked about how certainly not how the political engages with the psychoanalytic is for us to be proselytizing our clients or our patients, or like, that's certainly something that I think lies beyond the limit. Mm. We have an interview at the end of this season with Orna Goralnik, and she and I get into some very interesting hypothetical cases where, what happens when you have a patient who is very angry about, for example, his wife not having dinner ready, and it challenges everything that you think about feminism. It's a good discussion. I still don't know the correct answer. I think it depends on the case. I think there is, in that Buberian sense, room for me to be authentic and to challenge my patients on what the CBT people would call false beliefs, So should your wife have dinner ready when you get home from work? And I do that kind of challenge. And also in this season, there have been some very rich discussions. And I'm thinking particularly about with Donna Orange about the limits of that. And specifically as we get into the Israel-Gaza or however we're going to nomenclature that, into this conflict that's happening in Gaza, but by the hands of the Israeli military against largely Palestinian civilians, how the limits of mutuality are very much there, right? That, like, this is not an equal-sized thing. I mean, I love Martin Buber, and he's foundational, and even Donna, in our conversation, says Buber was a giant. Even Levinas thought Buber was a giant. But there's a different way to think about the ethical position.
I don't know. I think this is part of the field, particularly in the States. There's a long history of, in terms of revolutionary spirit within psychoanalysis, whether it's Fanon or Fromm or the Frankfurt School, it's, you know, it's there of the assumption of these ideas are incendiary. These ideas are moving towards, I don't know, the application of them can literally change the world in that way.
Yeah.
And I think there's the risk there of, I wonder if the field got captured in a very specific moment in the last few years, as, you know, the old institutions, the old orders are struggling and sputtering and really just, you know, threatening to collapse in terms of maintaining the order we're used to. I don't know. I wonder if it got captured by this notion that all encounter, this very Foucauldian notion of all encounter is an encounter of positionality and of power, and every encounter is a political encounter. Well, I'm sensitive that as practitioners, we have to be reflexive about our own positionality, our own confluence with regimes of power. I don't know. I think there are limits to what we offer as a revolutionary act. And I think the revolution is between two people.
Yes.
And what comes from that, I don't know. It's an ephemeral encounter. And I think, I wonder if there's something about the language of revolution that kind of got metabolized into the field, and I'm not sure how helpful it was. In the same way that you could look at something like pure person-centered therapy, like in its Rogerian mold, and say that it got so captured by sort of post-war individualism that it had nothing to say about the social. It had nothing to say about society. It had nothing to say about human beings and the way they actually live, because it was so obsessed with individual actualization.
Sure.
I do think there's kind of another shift here to go, Christ, there's only so much we can do. And ultimately, the encounter is rooted in some effort for human beings to find one another, to be visible, and to have some empathic connection.
Well, and I think that gets back to some sentiments that Karin Morota has expressed on this show before, which is a very real-world pragmatic approach to what we do, and that we have a fiduciary responsibility, but we're not saints, right?
No.
We can't save the world, and we're not special. We're just, we have a training.
I think you used the word proselytize earlier. We're not in the business of doing that.
No.
You know, we're not in the business of enforcing morality. I mean, what you described as what we could see as like a mundane therapeutic challenge of pointing out the guy who thinks that, you know, his wife should have dinner on the table. I would say that is the revolution. That's it. And again, I'm sort of speaking as an existentialist here, as someone deeply committed to phenomenology. All we can do is hold up the mirror and what they do with it.
Yeah, exactly. And the way I think about it is, instead of proselytizing or challenging with my sense of feminism, I don't even need to have a sense of feminism to say that doesn't work.
No, it doesn't work.
Is that really working?
Yeah.
Here is something where, again, I can say I learn a lot from Dr. Shedler. The way he talks about, are we doing something that works for more than one? And I've used this logic on my toddlers. You know, when I play with them and they, you know, the oldest, especially when she tells me, no, Papa, you're playing it wrong. And I say, hey, kiddo, this doesn't work for both of us to play this way. You got to find ways of playing that work for two. That's kind of where I've gone with that hypothetical patient when I see something to challenge and I say, is this working for you or is it working for both of you to demand dinner being done?
Think about the alternative. If the professional remit is to challenge behaviors that we find unacceptable or to sort of use the therapeutic encounter to take down political orders to which we're not aligned. Fucking hell, who am I to go around shouting at people about how they're living their lives?
No, but I think there is a fine line to say, how are we thinking about it? Not to challenge the behavior, but like, that hypothetical client, and it's not actually hypothetical because it's happened in my treatment room before. That hypothetical client has an understanding that is not making his or anyone around his life
easier. Absolutely. I would say the remit of our revolution is not so much to situate that which within political regimes, because then you're gonna get into a political discourse in which one side's gonna pull and the other side's gonna pull,
100%.
And everyone's gonna go to their positions. The revolution there is a relational one. You can help them to encounter in the here and now what they're saying, what's going on, and to gain some sense of empathy for how it might be for their partner to encounter that, what it might be like for you as a clinician to hear those demands. In what ways might those demands for food when they come home, is that playing out within the therapeutic relationship? Are there other demands they're making without knowing it? Mm-hmm. You know, is this about misogyny or is this about a pattern of relationship that bleeds all sorts of places? But again, the revolution is relational to me. It's not political. If there's a political awakening that comes from that, well, brilliant. But I see my job as to initiate a relational encounter from which someone might grow, and how they use that outside of the therapy room sort of isn't my business.
I think I agree. I think with the very practical way of thinking about it, I do think that the personal is political. But in terms of what happens with our job and in the treatment room, I agree with it, what you're saying. And I think this is where I started, was to say that actually, in a way, as much as I disagreed with what Shedler was saying, and as much as I thought he actually has a consistency problem.
Well, yeah, there's an incongruence there.
Part of what he said was, in a way, sustaining to my work. I entered into this place of, okay, I go to work and I'm there to serve. I'm there to serve the goals and the interests of helping my clients live more engaged and more authentic and more strategic
in their own choices and their own lives and their own relationships.
Yes. To say, okay, fascism is in the news. How does this affect you? What are we working on? Was fine.
Wait, what was fine? Help me understand.
To say, okay, you're scared about what happens in the news. What are you and I working on?
The engagement with the outside world, and whether it's like we all have seen this, things around like eco-anxiety, the billowing fear about climate change and where it's heading, anxieties about economic precarity, specific to Britain. This is in parallel to Trump. There were deep anxieties about Brexit that were happening like 2016 into 2019, COVID anxiety. I would say, again, when we're engaging with those, the way in which people meet those existential challenges, those shocks to order in the social, it's going to have some relevance to how they engage with other shocks in their life. It's going to have a relevance to how they navigate other relationships.
Sure.
So I would say, yeah, in terms of engaging with that, if we search our hearts, how we engage in issues around the social, politics, how we engage with capital probably speaks to how we are in our relationships as well. So yeah, to take that on board as a piece of what makes people people, fantastic, brilliant.
Right.
How it illustrates how people engage with the world, absolutely. May we be open to talking about that. But the idea that we have, I don't know, we are charged with moderating, with informing opinion, I don't think I want that responsibility.
No. I'm not the best person for it anyway.
Who the fuck am I, man? Like, imagine if you go to a therapist in need, in crisis, and I don't know, they start talking about the benefits of ivermectin, or they start quoting Jordan Peterson. It cuts both ways.
Yeah, yeah. Therapists, in many ways, have gotten away from like really what it is that we're here to do.
Yeah.
And I'm not saying I'm immune to it. You know, it's always a temptation. I heard an interview with a climate scientist who, it was really enlightening. He talked about doomism and how the fossil fuel companies are funding these narratives of doomism to promote kind of like giving up.
Yeah, to paralysis. Yeah.
And his point was, we're not moving fast enough, but there still is a point to trying. We cannot give in to this narrative that there's no point. It was mind-blowing because I hear this anxiety in my treatment room all the time. I hear the doomism all the time, that we're all fucked and that the world is on fire and that we're, and that, you know, that there's no point. And I thought, and for him to say this is actually a narrative from the jaded capitalistic fossil fuel companies from a climate scientist was like, by the way, here's another example of like me wanting to inform my clients. So now that I've heard this interview, I'm like, every time the doomism comes up, I'm like, you should go and listen to this interview. But again, that's not my job. And I guess it's just another example of how I'm not immune to it, that like really engaging in the fear and the way they relate to the fear is the point. But in my times of more burnout, I don't do well at that.
So I think doomism is a good example, because there is a level of paralysis or a level, and it's something I struggle with as someone who has spent over 20 years being incredibly politically engaged. I find myself over the last 10 years, because of my, you know, my own social position, wanting to check out and go, tell me, just wake me when it's over.
Yeah.
I think in saying that we don't have a proselytizing function, that doesn't mean that we can't accomplish incredible things with people and in their lives in terms of awakening, in terms of consciousness building. And that's such a pretentious fucking thing to say. But I think there's something about this notion of paralysis and doomism. Doomism is not just related to eco-anxiety or fucking Trump or, you know, it's a part of the human situation. You know, to assume hope is lost. And I think this, what can we do in a relational therapeutic encounter? I'll reference Hannah Arendt again. Agency as not only a public engagement, but a relational engagement, that we build a sense of possibility, of capability by being seen by the other, but also in attempting to, despite the isolation between the two of us, attempting to bridge that gap, to be seen, to come into contact, but also to gain a sense of initiative, a sense of beginning, a sense of possibility. Yeah. And again, I can feel my existentialist juices, all systems that go here, but that's the gig here. That's a revolution that to me is far more profound than monitoring political awareness or political opinion. It is trying to embolden a sense of possibility. And I think there's something in the encounter that can actually fucking do it. There's your revolution.
Bravo.
Goddamn, I can feel Nietzsche on my shoulder going, yes, or.
This all started with you asking, what was it like to be switched off? Something you just said does remind me of what it was like to be switched off. Because when I was switched off on psychotherapy, something else was switched on. In our off years here, it's been our longest break. And I talk about it in our next episode where I talk with my buddy Caleb. There was something that was switched on where I could not think about this stuff when I wasn't engaged with patients. If I wasn't doing family responsibilities, which was a huge portion of my time, I was creatively turned on. It feels like it makes sense, but it was surprising.
So what, when the intensity of focus or aliveness of the work was decreased, intensity of focus, aliveness of other stuff was increased? Creative stuff?
Well, so I would actually say the work was more alive, but it was contained to the hours I was there. Hmm. My job was even further out of my mind when I wasn't there. I could not think about the podcast. I didn't do a lot of reading. Going to my consult group at times was a slog, not because of the people in my consult group, but because like I was so dead to the work as soon as I clocked out. It was like a job. It was like punching a clock. And then as soon as I punched out of the clock of dad time, there was something, you know, with those few hours of free time I would get a week where I was just like hungry for creativity. And the podcast has been part of how I've channeled my creativity in the past. It wasn't at that time. I would say it's back now, but.
You know, what you're describing, you went through a period where your work was effective. You didn't feel like you were as alive, or it didn't have the resonance of other periods of your professional life.
Yes.
But you kept going, you engaged in other things. You know, you had to adjust how you were working or your engagement with the work it was sort of boundaried when you were in the consulting room.
Mm-hmm. Yeah,
I think this notion that we should just be on fire and sort of porous and alive and just in this never-ending exchange of self-reflection and theoretical engagement. I mean, we do provide a service.
Mm-hmm.
It has limited boundaries. It has limited contours. It's a job sometimes. Sometimes it's transcendent. Sometimes it's life-changing for us and for other people. Sometimes it's a job where you are a tradesman. And I don't know. I'm not sure that's that bad of a place to be in.
No, Mason, I'm saying I liked it. I liked it.
Good.
And, you know, you're reminding me of something that Steve Kuchek says in our upcoming interview with him. He said, usually what benefits the therapist benefits the patient. Usually. I think this would be an example. The fact that I wasn't thinking about psychotherapy outside of work and had something that was invigorating me, which for the first time since high school was visual art.
Yeah.
It was world-changing for my work. I'm not presenting to you a problem. I'm presenting to you this really interesting time in my work.
I'm also struck that you historically have always maintained a vastly larger caseload than I ever have.
Yeah, I work a lot.
I have always been amazed at, for as long as I've known you in practice, in terms of client hours.
I don't talk about it publicly because there's judgment, but it's a lot, yeah.
I mean,
you know, and when I talk to Lane, you know, my former therapist about it, he's, you know, he kind of, this classic Lane, but he would normalize and say, hey, in the 70s, this was what we all did.
Yeah, absolutely.
You know, I think what he was saying is like, you know, in a different generation, we would have had that kind of workhorse mentality. But yes, I think what you're speaking to is the need for me to be doing stuff that sustains me.
Even if we're going to look at theory, think about what, you know, the decade of the example you used,
mm-hmm.
of the 70s. Think of every advancement in every major therapeutic modality since the 60s and 70s. Mm-hmm. Every one of them is moving towards greater transparency, greater relational entanglement, the relationship as the real engine of treatment, but also as part of that engine of treatment, it is the visibility and the engagement of the clinician in that encounter. Certainly in my own experience in practice over the last 10 years, I have always done it in conjunction with other things. I now see I have two client days a week and I teach for 3 days a week.
Mm-hmm.
And on top of that, might do other things. In some ways, yes, it's a job, it's a skill set. We are tradesmen and tradeswomen, tradespeople. In some ways. But in other ways, we are the instruments of the work. Our lives, our relationships, our histories, our passions, the things that move us, are the inescapable sort of instrument of what happens in facilitating a relational encounter. And that instrument is honed and is made sharper and more interesting and more alive when our lives outside of the treatment room are alive and engaged.
Yeah.
And I think that's the big thing that we focus so much on how is the political being activated in the consultant room that we forget, like, how is just a sense of wonder and of joy? Are we cultivating that out there? And is it coming in? I would say that's far more profound.
Amen. That's been what I've found through my creative life over the last few years, and it's been, I think it sustains my job, it sustains my parenting. And then when I was ready to come back to the podcast, it was, I think, begrudging at first, and now it's not. I mean, I'm really excited about the interviews we've landed this season.
Mm-hmm.
It's been, at times, a little topsy-turvy of a process. It's hard to get people to talk, but we've gotten some really good people to talk, and we are talking about some very interesting topics. I was not planning on being topical at all this season, and then this disaster in the Middle East happened, and one of the things that I noticed was that professional organizations weren't really addressing it. I think it's too fevered, and then, you know me, of course, that compelled me to address it. You know, I'll preface it by saying it will be fumbly, it won't be perfect, I don't know. I think it's very deep and nuanced in the way we address it. It'll be more towards the end of the season.
To address the moment, to address politics in all its complexity, it requires such intensity. It requires such focus that you can very easily lose sight of so many other facets of being alive. And also the fact that finding connection, the act of creation, takes ebb and flow. It takes time stepping away from the thing.
Yeah.
Whereas politics sort of demands constant grinding, nagging, everyday engagement, because that's how it tells itself change comes about.
I would add to that, politics requires emphatic, clear statements. In psychotherapy...
Yeah, the absence of ambivalence.
Yes. Even something is, you know, and I thought a lot about this. In a whole season about racism in America, I never once said the phrase Black Lives Matter. Of course I believe that Black Lives Matter. I believe that it is like an imperative for a therapist to believe that Black Lives Matter. And yet the statement is a political slogan that is, you know, apart from what happens in psychotherapy. I think it was Anton Hart that said, you know, it's a psychotherapy is a complexifying process.
It's a desperately impure process. Mm-hmm. And I think that the current political moment, and I think this is a phenomenon that has reached much greater intensity of the States in terms of Britain, just because British people are resigned to being disenfranchised and miserable. And the highest honor in British life is to suffer without complaining. That's morality. That's as close as Britain has to some sort of secular transcendence.
That's a good dad to me, is someone who suffers without complaining.
Exactly. And I wish I could do it. This is why, as Anglicized as I am, I'm a terrible British person. So I can't stop complaining. Politics demands, to your point, and it's a really good one, it demands urgency and it demands a sort of clarity of message and a clarity of intent that is sort of uniform, that is moving, it's unidirectional. We're moving in one way. This thing has to happen and it has to happen in this way. And the discourse around a certain thing has to be a thing. It's going to be this thing because that's going to get us there. When in reality, the most important moments of therapy are confronting tension, confronting ambivalence, confronting not this or that, but this end.
Yeah.
If we attempt to strip that away, I think we're denying what makes human beings, which is we're all over the shop all the time. That's what it is to be human, but to somehow make choices in spite of it, to live in spite of ambivalence.
Hear, hear.
Hear, hear.
I'm excited about the season. I keep thinking, like, when is the sustainability going to run out? What won't run out is wanting to contribute something. It's just like what that looks like might change.
I go through the same process in terms of composing music. Mm-hmm. For the seasons, I start out every season going, oh God, what the fuck am I going to write?
Yeah.
And I'll sit at a keyboard and I'll just play like C major, like, oh boy. And then slowly through the expenditure of going, no, just listen, what is he saying? What are they talking about? What moves you in that? You know, you slowly lumber towards something. Something emerges. Something happens.
You do a great job. It's a good sounding season. But you and I are going to talk again when I interviewed Donna Orange. What people don't see behind the scenes is that how you kind of keep me grounded and are an important editorial voice in this process. And when we get to talking more about the stuff happening in the Middle East, I'm going to want to talk to you more about why it's important to me as a half Jewish person to engage, and why it's important for us as a profession to engage. You know, I think you're right in that it's not always important for us to engage, but how we engage is important.
It will be an interesting conversation. I'm very much looking forward to that because she is a beast.
Yeah.
Donna Orange. She's the thing, man. I teach her all the time. She's brilliant.
And I'm sorry that I'm teasing our listeners because it's still a ways away from when we air it. But I was really worried about talking to someone who's so ethical. And it wasn't that way at all. Like, she was so personable and comforting and human, and we get into talking about fun and whether fun is important. It was great. I loved talking
to her. This is the whole fucking point. I think as you progress through the work and as you go through ebbs and flows, it's something that I remind myself all the time. It's something I remind my students all the time. As someone who is deeply interested in philosophy and technology and sociology and theory, just like you are, at the end of the day, in terms of what facilitates an effective, moving, emergent psychotherapeutic encounter, it is a sense of aliveness. It is not being clever. It is not an adherence to theoretical consistency. It is engagement and presence and a willingness to engage in all of the things that make us human.
Thanks, Mason. Love you, buddy.
Hey, love you too, but hang in there, man. I know this is a weird time.
Yeah.
Between Us is produced by myself and Mason Neely, who also composes our music. Our research assistant is Rose Bergdahl. If you enjoy the show, find us where you find podcasts and subscribe. And if you can, leave a review. And until next time, take care.